Okay. The family by the name of... Put it on. There was a family by the name of Traunstein that lived on the street. They were Viennese Jews. And they seemed very gay and happy people. But in some respects, they did not seem to us Jewish at all. They did not belong to any synagogue, nor to any organization of Jews. And we never saw Jews come to visit them. But we did hear Mrs. Traunstein to say, "I'm a Jew and I'm proud of it." There was no question about that. Her husband was a very quiet and reserved man. And the Traunstein children all played brass instruments, so that on warm summer evenings, the windows were wide open, the trumpet and the trombone and the flutes and things were going madly. They obviously had a good time, and we enjoyed having them for neighbors. However, my sister Dorothy told my mother that she saw Mrs. Traunstein putting milk and meat on the same plate. And of course, my mother said, "Remember, you are never to eat anything in their house." Across the street was a rather gracious house occupied by the Sonnabans. And Mrs. Sonnabend used to play the piano. I don't remember anything about Mr. Sonnabend, but their son was about the same age as my brother Eli, and they used to walk to Sunday school together. But I did hear my father say, in a somewhat surly way, "Sie seinen Deutschen," which explained why they weren't friendly. Subsequently, Mr. Sonnabend became president of the American Jewish Committee, as you know. Now, I mention these things merely to give you an idea that we weren't completely surrounded, although preponderantly, by Irish Americans. I do remember the heavy Irish brogue of our next door neighbor, and I remember him referring to the ladybugs on the bushes as God's cows. And my mother said, "At home, we also called the ladybugs Gott's Kielach."
Isn't that interesting?
Did you ever hear that?
No.
Yeah.
Put that on again.
Yes. Now,
by the way, ladybugs are in great vogue, you know.
Oh, I know. They're popular with all of us.
They're very in insect.
Yes. Yes. Now, how can I summarize for you the general environment in which we lived? Our home was certainly very Jewish in character. And yet, on Saturday, my father went to the store. And may I say that now you must, whenever I use the word store, think of it as capitalized. It was an entity. It was a personality in itself, almost a demon. It tyrannized over the life of the family. My father awoke in the morning and recited his prayers with his tefillin on, having wrapped the bands around his arm and put the box on his head and on his arm, the box in which was the basic prayer of Judaism, reminding him of our obligation to abide by the laws of God. And he never just murmured his prayers the way Uncle Abe did. He sang his prayers aloud and ornamented them with cadenzas of all sorts. He loved his prayers. And we woke in the morning to the sound of his voice singing very happily. And then he of course wore the prayer shawl with the fringes. And after he had performed this ritual and had his breakfast, he went off to work in the store, opening it at 7:30 in the morning and staying there until 9 in the evening. This was a tyranny which he gladly accepted. Didn't think of it as tyranny. This was part of the great American way. On Friday evening, he closed the store at 6 o'clock, came home to a house in which the ritual of Sabbath predominated. The table was always laid with white linen, the silver. We had a four-branched candle holder, and my mother arched her hands over the candles and recited the blessing of the candles. My father raised the goblet of wine and sang the Kiddush, and then sliced bread from that twisted loaf, that shiny twisted loaf, and recited the bracha, the blessing over bread, and then he passed pieces of bread around to everyone. The wine he sipped, and he offered my brother a sip. None for the girls. He said the girls would raise mustaches if they drank the wine. So we didn't get any wine. But this was a very important part of the Sabbath evening. And of course, the meal was never very original. It generally started with gefilte fish, and then was followed by noodle soup, chicken soup with noodles, and then chicken, and some vegetables, and stewed prunes, I think, or some very, very simple dessert with sponge cake, and a glass of tea, not a cup of tea, a glass of tea. And it was taken at leisure, and it was very pleasant and relaxed. And that was it. On Saturday morning, my mother always sighed because my father had to go to business. But it never occurred to him to question that she would observe the Sabbath very carefully at home. No work, no hard work was ever done on Saturday morning. We always had food that had been cooked the day before, and nobody pounded or indulged in any raucous play. It was Sabbath. My mother did not go to the synagogue every Saturday. She didn't like the idea of going alone because my father wasn't there. We children did go to the religious school, and whenever the holidays came, of course, they went. But she did not go on Saturdays. The Sabbath was observed in the home as really a day of rest and remembrance of their childhood and of the family back home. Is there still
some? No, lots more.
Yes, all right. Now, how can I tell you about our life? The primary goals of our parents were security, of course, and the education of the children. There was just no question in anybody's mind, of course, that my brother would go on to college. The concept of Harvard just percolated through every crevice of their lives. And all of the friends who had come from the same town who had boys, they were all heading for Harvard. They'd never heard of any other institution of learning, and they were all going to Harvard. Apparently in those days it wasn't too much question about whether they could or could not get in. The numerous Klauses had not yet been introduced. And of course my mother had a gleam in her eye about what her son was to do. But she also had a gleam in her eye about what her daughter was to do. And in this, I think she was a little bit unique and distinctive. Never having been taught to read anything beyond phonetic Yiddish, she always deplored it. She said, "I am blind. I have not known how to read." She never learned how to read English. and we never could teach her. We children could never correct her. It was just inconceivable that we would say to Mama, "That's wrong, Mama, don't say that." I remember she always referred to citizener, never to a citizen, but to a citizener, never to a remnant, but a remnitz. And we knew perfectly well it was wrong, but we never could say, "Don't say that." And later, she kind of scolded us for that. She said, "We should have helped her. We should have told her. Maybe we should have." But it just didn't go with the relationship between parent and child. I don't remember that Mama ever had to tell us anything twice. Her voice was authoritative. It was the voice of authority. And because my father wasn't home very much, he left the house in the morning and came back late, she really controlled our destinies as far as our education was concerned. And although she always said that my father was the head of the family, we knew that she was really the head of the family, because she made the decisions about us and for us. I'll never forget the time when my father was making some change in his business. He was moving over from one store on Roxbury Street to another, and for about 4 days he was home. This was something absolutely unheard of. And my mother said, "Nathan, this would be a good time for us to go to town and buy a piano." He said, "My God, woman, are you crazy? Here I am, a man without work, with 4 children, and you want me to go and buy a piano?" Oh, she said, "Yes, I know, that's true. But you know, we have 3 daughters. They have got to learn something. And if we don't get the piano for them now, they won't have any use for it later on." And in her gentle, persuasive way, she arranged it that they went to town, and knowing absolutely nothing about an instrument, bought a very good piano.
Steinway, no doubt.
And it lasted, it served in our front parlor for about 35 years. It was an upright. And I remember all the children in the neighborhood standing around on the street. And the furniture mover came, and they clambered up to the roof and had a giant hook on the roof, and they lifted the piano by ropes on the side of the house up to the window and worked it into the window and into our living room. And there it remained as the absolute central focus of our lives for as long as we lived in that house. And subsequently, wherever we lived, it went with us. But it became a very important part of our life and our education. We all had piano lessons, and we all practiced more or less. My brother kind of wearied of the practicing after a year or two, and he quit. Years later, he reproached Mama for not insisting on him continuing. But we all played the piano, and not only played, but we sang. We had popular editions of, I remember, a book of opera songs. And we stopped at nothing. High notes and low notes meant nothing. Il Trovador, and you know, we emulated Rosa Rice and all the rest of the singers. And we had an awful lot of fun around that piano. And my father, too. And then we began getting songs from New York, the Yiddish songs. And Kum Yisrolik Kum Aheim, do you remember that? And, Koshinkis mit Mandlin, of course, everybody knew that. And there were any number of them, and we sang them. My mother would stand by the door. She loved the old familiar melodies, but the Brabmans were not singers. I think the only thing I ever heard my mother sing was Aile Lule. You know, she'd rock a baby to sleep with this Aile Lule. And she did like Koshinkis mit Mandlin particularly, but she never knew the names, the words of songs. But my father never forgot the words of songs. If he once heard them, he knew them. Singing was an important part of our life. And on Sundays, we had lots of company. I think the immigrants were lonely. You know, I don't think we think enough about that, what it meant for these youngsters to come to a new country, a new language, new culture, and to make a new life for themselves. And that's why our door was always open, and they knew that Mama was cordial to them and my father, and she always helped them over the bumps, as she said, from being a greenhorn to becoming a Yankee. So that was a very important part of their life. And on Sundays, when the women would come in, many of them were wearing big hats with willow plumes. That was already a mark of prosperity. And the ladies wore tight corsets, laced up real tight around the waist, and big bosoms. And they would lay their hats and coats on one of the beds in the bedroom. And we kids would wait until they got into the other room and go in and try on the hats. Oh, we loved those hats. They were just as big as architectural monstrosities. But, oh, that was a very important part of our life when we try on their hats. And then they chatted a lot, and they brought the news to each other. The newcomers would bring the news, and especially news from the old country.
It's maybe out. I'm not quite sure how to tell.
No, I've turned this off now.
I feel buffaloed enough by this thing that I don't want to write.
The guests and friends would sit in the parlor or in the back parlor. Sometimes my father would be made happy if some of them would agree to play whist with him. I never played for money. I never saw prizes or winnings exchanged in our house. As a rule, most of the players were very poor players, although Papa's excellent memory stood him in good stead, and he could really walk off with anything. But as a rule, he had to put up with some very unsatisfactory partners. My Aunt Libby loved to gnaw on an apple when she was playing, and my Aunt Ray always forgot what was trump.
I'm sorry, I don't see his turning anymore.
Is it off?
It must.
The men talked about politics in Boston. We often heard the name of John F. Fitzgerald. There was a good deal of comment on the international scene, the Russo-Japanese War, the beginnings of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, and that kind of thing. But those were just topics of conversation. And generally speaking, my mother was interested in the news from home, as she called it, from the old country. And they often gathered money among themselves to send to take care of some of the poor landslide in the little village of Dogue, or where Mama came from, or Cazares, where Papa came from. In Boston itself, we were still in a community that was dominated by the wealthy German Jews, who were much more acclimated to American life than these later arrivals from Eastern Europe. The German Jews had what money makes available, access to advanced education, better homes in better neighborhoods, clothes, vacation, education for their children. And this we must never forget, they originated many of the social institutions that were used for the benefit of the newcomers. The work for the aged, the home for the aged, the orphanages, They even had associations which provided for young girls and boys. So it, the dominance in the community still lay in the hands of the German Jews, as we have seen in other communities too. There was no social interrelationship between them and our Eastern Jewish
Lillian, immigrants. Were you aware of the Council of Jewish Women at that time?
No.
That name did
no.
not.
It came, well, by the time I was in college, I remember my mother. My mother was a member. And, of course, the she was on the board, very early on the board of the Home for Aged. And...
You must have shut yours off.
Yes.
Is it on?
Yes. Now...
I'm glad we have two.
I'm just trying to think of what else would have intrigued you in that particular period.
Well, when you talked about some of these institutions, I do think originated with council, particularly concerned about girls.
In Pittsburgh, I knew. But
we followed the national trend.
Yes. Of course, as I said, now I mentioned the orphanages, the
no,
Helping
that would
Hands
have been separate
Society.
And the Home
that
for the Aged.
Right. The Home for the Aged was also our Eastern Jews. And that was kind of where my mother felt more at home. Although later, as I said, she did become a member and a little bit more active in some of those other things. I do recall that we had visitors in our home. There were not only the black-garbed shaliach, the people who came to collect contributions for the institutions in Jerusalem, but I remember once when the Berensons came to visit, Alter and Judith Berenson, although they called themselves Albert and Julia, but their Jewish names were Alter Berenson and Judith Berenson. There is a good reason why I remember these names, because eventually my life was to be intertwined more intimately with theirs, since I married eventually a cousin of the Berensons. But the Berensons were an old Boston family, Lewis Berenson, tall, lanky man, who was the first of the Dogger to come to Boston and established himself quite firmly. He had six or seven sons who were destined to play rather important roles in the community. And he was a cousin of this Alter Berenson who came to visit my mother and with his wife. And he told us that he wanted to talk to us about our grandparents because perhaps we might not remember them. And he did remember them. And he was... At that time, his son had already found his place not only at Harvard University, but had gone to Italy to begin his great career as an art connoisseur and to take up his life in Itati near Florence. His wife's name, Judith, repeats itself in the life of my husband's mother and of our daughter, Judith. I can't go into any great detail. There are many individual recollections which are significant, but probably repeat the pattern of others' lives in Boston. In 1914, of course, when just at a time when my mother was beginning to think she would like to go to Europe to visit her father, the First World War broke out and brought an end to those thoughts completely. And then I had completed my 4 years at the Girls' Latin School, where I acquired a college education at public expense. The Girls' Latin School was a college preparatory school operated by the city and comparable to the Boys' Latin School. which makes me a buddy of Bishop Wright. He always puts his arm around me and says, we graduated from the same school. It really wasn't the same school. It was Cardinal Wright, who also graduated from the Latin school, felt that we were buddies because I had come from the girls' Latin school. But in 1914, I graduated and entered Radcliffe College, which was, of course, a milestone in my life. But it was something that would not have happened if it had not been for my mother's strong persistence. Shall I tell you the story of why I went to Radcliffe? You can discard this story if you want to. But my mother had heard me say that at the school we often had speakers who encouraged us to go on. At the grammar school that I went to, the Dillaway Grammar School, which was a girls' school, they, in those days, speakers would come to encourage the pupils to go on to high school, because a lot of girls did not go to high school. And one of the schools that they told about was the girls' Latin school. So I told my mother about it. I didn't think too much about it, but I told her about it. And one Sunday, when we had had that wonderful, big, voluminous Sunday dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and as had become custom in our house, my father went into the kitchen